In 1 Corinthians 1, 26 through 30, it says this: "Take a good look, friends, at who you were when you got called into this life. I don't see many of the brightest and the best among you, not many influential, not many from high society families. Isn't it obvious that God deliberately chose men and women that their culture overlooks and exploits and abuses, chose these nobodies to expose the hollow pretensions of the somebodies? That makes it quite clear that none of you can get by blowing your own horn before God. Everything that we have, right thinking, right living, a clean slate, and a fresh start, comes from God by way of Jesus Christ." Well, the great theologian N.T. Wright tells the story of a man named Cosmo Gordon Lang, which, by the way, is a great name. I mean, if you're looking for a name, Cosmo, I mean, whether it's for a puppy or, you know, a new addition to your family, I mean, Cosmo is an awesome name. But he tells the story of a man named Cosmo who was the Archbishop of Canterbury from 1928 to 1942. And as he's reaching this time of retirement, Cosmo shares with a friend really kind of a fear that he had in making this big transition in his life. And he says this. He says, "Having been somebody, I shall now be nobody." And I love the vulnerability and the honesty of this quote. It's much like the honesty in actor Matt Damon's observation that it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. See, our culture is really defined by being a somebody, whether it's through a career, achievement, being an actor, I mean, whatever it might be, having some kind of fame, notoriety, celebrity, some sort of achievement that everyone has to take notice, something that's unique about each and every one of us. That's what our culture is defined by. And if we don't have it, then we need to be connected to somebody who does. I mean, that's what, you know, kind of Facebook and social media is all about, right? I mean, we can all maybe do that 6 degrees to Kevin Bacon now. I mean, I think it's all possible. And really, you know, some have even observed that we live in a TGIF sort of culture, a Twitter, a Google, Instagram, Facebook sort of culture. That this is what really is shaping our lives now. And even as I think about, you know, my own children, that they're growing up in a world in which they've never known not being connected to the world. So not only are they, you know, not being defined by their small group of friends or maybe their interactions at school or on a sports team, but they're being defined by the entire world, the globe at their fingertips. And I see this as my kiddos will watch YouTube videos of all these YouTube families, and I'll go and watch, and they're just kind of talking, playing games, you know, maybe playing some sort of, you know, eat this sort of challenge, or maybe they're taking these amazing vacations to places, and I just kind of go, hey, why are these people famous? And they just go, I don't know, they're just a family. But they love to watch them, right? Our culture is defined by being a somebody. But it makes me wonder, where do you and I find our identities? What is it that shapes who we are? How do we think about ourselves, our place in the world, how we interact with other people? What is it that really makes us significant? And that's one of the themes that we see in this movie, Star Wars: The Last Jedi. Now, The Last Jedi is maybe the most recent Star Wars movie, if we're not counting Solo. Not many of y'all saw Solo, but most of you maybe have seen The Last Jedi. It made $1.3 billion, something like that. So a few people around the world saw this movie, and it's the sequel to Star Wars: The Force Awakens. It's kind of the new set of trilogies that's really the sequel to those original iconic Star Wars movies. And in this, we're following a couple of new characters, and one of them is Rey. And Rey is a young woman who grew up on this planet, Jakku, in the middle of nowhere, and she discovers that she has these force powers, and she finds herself caught up in this story that's been going on that we've been watching in the original trilogies, right? She finds herself caught up in this story. And so she sets off to find Luke Skywalker. And so she wants Luke Skywalker to step into this role of a legend that he seemingly has. But Luke has been missing for years. And she finally goes and finds him. And what she finds is somebody who doesn't really want to step in to that identity that everyone else wants him to have. One day, Jesus is walking with his disciples, and they're almost to this city called Caesarea Philippi. And there, Jesus goes and asks them a question. Who do the people say that I am? It's kind of the equivalent of Jesus sort of Googling himself, right? And the disciples answer him, well, the people say you're John the Baptist, or maybe some say you're Elijah, some say you're Jeremiah. And then Jesus says, but who do you say I am? You see, Jesus wasn't Googling himself with his disciples and with the people to really kind of find his own identity or to be affirmed himself, but he was really asking his disciples, what do they think of who he is and what they've been doing? Jesus wants to kind of gauge their hearts. What are they observing? What are they seeing? What do they think that they really are a part of? And I see that's what Luke is doing with Ray as he's continuing to ask her, yeah, but who are you? And she's saying, you know, we need help with the resistance. We need you to stand against the empire. And Luke is saying, okay, but who are you? What brings you here? Why is it that you are the one to come when so many others could have come? What has brought you exactly? And so as Jesus asks this question, then Peter, in all of his boldness, speaks up that you are the Christ, the Messiah, the one that we've been waiting for, the one sent by God. You are the Son of God. And Jesus says to him, flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven. Jesus says to him, okay, now that you know this, who are you, Peter? Because you, Peter, upon this confession, I will build my church. We translate it church, but it's this assembly, this group of people, this movement of people in the world who are defined by faith, hope, and love. And Jesus says the gates of hell will not be able to stand against it. Because as they're walking along this path and they're walking towards a city called Caesarea Philippi, it's so interesting that our scriptures leave, you know, no unnecessary detail, because this city was a bit of a celebrity sort of city. It was a city that Alexander the Great fell in love with when he came to this area and conquered this area. It had this seemingly bottomless pool of water that filled up the Jordan River, and they even dedicated this cave to the Greek god Pan. And they said that there was a gate to Hades down in there. And then the current Caesar loved it so much that he had a statue built, and that's why it was called Caesarea Philippi. They had a statue built to his celebrity and to his status. It was one of those kind of places that you would go to. And Jesus said, in the midst of all this popularity, in the midst of this kind of culture, in the midst of these kind of ideas and thoughts, why are you following me? What do you think this is all about? Jesus had just fed 5,000 people. Jesus had just walked on water. Jesus was attracting crowds and teaching them. And then Jesus teaches 4,000 people. And he's walking along this path and he's saying, why are you a part of this? Is it to be part of the crowds? Is it to be part of something significant? What do you really think all this is about? Because I happen to think that Jesus' culture is not too different from our culture. We're just more connected than we ever have been, but this same part inside of us that wants to be connected to something greater than us is still there. It was there in Jesus' time. It was there in those disciples who left everything to follow him, but had to kind of discover what Jesus was about along the way. And Jesus is saying, this is what it's about. Upon this confession, I'm going to call a group of people who are defined by love. And it's by these group of people who live sacrificially, who live obediently, who trust in a God, who live by faith and hope beyond themselves. These are the kind of people that evil cannot stand against, that injustice cannot stand against, that mistakes cannot stand against, that sin cannot stand against. It's these kind of people that I'm forming and that I want you to be. In another place, Jesus says, they will know that you're my disciples when you love one another. You see, in a culture that values significance over substance, Jesus tells us that when we love, that's when we become somebody. Because throughout our scriptures, we see that God so often called the nobodies. As Paul was writing to that church in Corinth, he wanted to remind them that when they get caught up in the celebrity, and they get caught up in the fame, and they get caught up in all these other things in which they can put their identity, he says, remember who you are when God called you. That you didn't come from the right families, you didn't come from the right status in society, but God called you to be something greater than you are because of the work of Christ that's at work in your life before you even realized it, that's at work now and will continue to work so that you reflect the image of Jesus to the world, so that all people may know them and us by our love. See, one of the great questions in The Last Jedi and in Force Awakens was, who are Rey's parents? Rey essentially comes from nowhere. She didn't know her parents. And of course, if you're into this sort of stuff and you have a Star Wars t-shirt on, then maybe you're kind of into all the speculation as to who Rey's parents would have been. You know, kind of went for the last 2 years, right? You know, was Rey maybe like the daughter of Luke Skywalker? Was she maybe, you know, a daughter of Obi-Wan Kenobi, who was Luke's teacher? Or maybe, you know, it's Star Wars, it's science fiction. You know, was she a clone of Luke, or maybe the Emperor? I mean, you know, this stuff gets a lot of fun if you, like, read it and stuff. And so everyone was kind of speculating who's Rey's parents may be. But in this scene in which her and Ben Solo have a bit of a confrontation, and Ben Solo is a nephew of Luke Skywalker, who's taken up the mantle of Darth Vader, that they have this exchange, and Ben Solo essentially tells her who her parents are. I love that line. I don't like love it because it's a great line, but I think it really reveals where Ben Solo is when he says, you're nothing, you have no place in this story. You see, when I think about all the kind of speculation that we had about who's Rey's parents are, and to be perfectly honest, all those Star Wars fans in your life, and maybe you're one of those, and maybe you were a little disappointed. I mean, this is one of the big, people aren't too happy with this movie because of that. Because we all want Rey to be somebody. We want her to be a Skywalker like Ben Solo, or we want her to be caught up in this story somehow, to have a real place. Because if she really is a nobody and her parents really were no one in particular, then really what is her place in this story? But yet that's the point. And really, when we think about this in terms of our faith, this is exactly what God does. Every time. In fact, there's a story in 2 Kings chapter 5, and it begins in this way. It says, Naaman was a general of the army under the king Aram, and he was important to his master, who held him in the highest esteem because it was by him that God had given victory to Aram, a truly great man, but afflicted with a grievous skin disease. And it so happened that Aram, on one of his raiding expeditions against Israel, captured a young girl who became a maid to Naam's wife. And one day she said to her mistress, oh, if only my master could meet the prophet of Samaria, he would be healed of his skin disease. Now Naam went straight to his master and reported what the girl from Israel had said. Well, then go, said the king of Aram, and I'll send a letter of introduction to the king of Israel. And so he went off, taking with him 750 pounds of silver and 150 pounds of gold and 10 sets of clothes. And so as Naam approached the king of Israel, he approaches and he hands him this letter and essentially says, you know, you are to cure me of my disease, and here's all the gifts I'm going to give. And the king says, who am I? Am I God that I can give and take away life? And he tears his clothes. And then the prophet in Samaria, Elisha, hears about this, and he says, send Naam to me. And Naam arrives with all of his entourage and this big parade and caravan to Elisha's house, but Elisha won't go out to see him. He sends instead a servant with this message, go and wash in the Jordan River 7 times and you'll be clean. And Naomi becomes so upset. He says, this prophet won't even come out and meet with me because Naomi's a general. He's important. And he has all of his people with him, but this prophet won't come out and see him. And so he begins to leave, upset. But Naomi's people come around him and they said, you know, if he'd asked you to do something difficult and heroic, you would have done it. So why not do this simple thing? And Naomi says, you know, we have better rivers than Damascus. I'm not going to go wash in this filthy stream. And they said, come on, at least try it. And so he goes and he washes and he comes out and his skin is like new. And then he comes and he bows before Elisha and he says, I'm sorry. Obviously, it's become so obvious to me that there is a God in Israel and this is the true God. And he goes on to say this. He offers his gifts, but Elisha won't take them. And he says, as God lives, the God who I'm serve, I'll take nothing from you. And Naam tried his best, but he wouldn't take it. And Naam says, if you won't take anything, then let me ask you for something. Give me a load of dirt, as much as a team of donkeys can carry, because I'm never again going to worship any other God other than God. But there's one thing from which I need God's pardon. When my master leans on my arm and enters the shrine of Rimmon, and I worship there, and I'm there with him, worshiping Rimmon, may you see to it that God forgives me for this. And Elisha says, everything will be all right. Go in peace. And what I love about this story is that this is really a story of a foreign general who has just went and attacked the people of God and has taken back a slave girl, but then has to go to those very same people and ask to be healed. And in the midst of this, God is working in his life, and then he has to go into the Jordan River to be baptized, and it's only then that he is healed. And then he comes and he says, I have to go back to my people, and I know that there's only one true God, but yet when my master leans on my arm, will you ask God to forgive me? It's a complex story, but I think it's a story that reflects life and the journey that so many of us are on. You know, here at Table of Grace, we talk about belong, believe, become. That each and every one of us are on a spiritual journey. That we may be at any moment where we're looking and we're asking, do we belong? Do we belong to God? Do we belong to these people? Is this a church I can belong to? And maybe we come to this point where we say, you know, I believe in Jesus, but what does it look like to really believe? How do I actually do that? How do I live? And maybe we come to a point where we believe in Christ and we're letting God begin to form us into the image of Jesus and we become more like Jesus. And sometimes we can experience all these in one day. But God is working in our lives in each and every one of those moments to say, you belong to me. Believe and confess. Give me your life. And I am with you and working through you. You are somebody to me. And what's so amazing about this story is that the true hero in this story of Naaman is a slave girl who was taken captive but didn't let her circumstances define how she loved. That here she was in this moment she couldn't control, but she says, my identity is not defined by my circumstances. My identity is defined by God. And what I would hope more than anything is this person that's in my life would know the grace of God that I know. If only he knew the prophet in Samaria, then I know that he would find the healing that he desires. See, for many of us here today, we're in circumstances we'd never choose. We're in situations we don't want to be in. Maybe we're around people who test our patience and test our faith. Maybe we're in these circumstances and we have a choice. What will define our lives and our identity? Because I think if we look to this slave girl, we would see an example of how we are to live and to love those people that are around us. It's not what they do that defines us and determines what we do, but it's what God has done for us. And how I kind of think about this and live this out, and I want to offer this up to you, is as you go about your week this week, and as you encounter people, just have this prayer in the background of your mind. And be praying, God, how can I love this person I'm interacting with right now? How can I love this person right now in this moment? How can I best express love to them? Maybe it's a word that you say. Maybe it's a thought that you communicate. Maybe it's choosing to be kind when they're not kind. Maybe it's giving them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it's offering up your presence and slowing down whatever your agenda might have been in that moment. But to say, God, as you have loved me, how can I love this person in this moment? Because God, that's what I want to do. Because that's how we become a people of love. A people who live this out no matter our circumstances, no matter what others around us are doing. But remember where our identity is found and begin to live that for other people. And that's what we see at the end of this movie. As we've had this story about people who were seemingly no one, who find that they actually are somebody. And we see the story of people who are supposed to be legends who say they don't want any part of that. We see that we're able to influence people that maybe we've never met before. Ephesians 5 and verse 1 says this, "Watch what God does, and then you do it, like children who learn proper behavior from their parents. Mostly what God does is love you. Keep company with him and learn a life of love. Observe how Christ loved us. His love was not cautious, but extravagant. He didn't love in order to get something from us, but to give everything of himself to us." Love like that. Will you pray with me? God, as we come to this place, we come from different places on our journeys. God, we come looking to belong, looking to believe, and looking to become. And Lord, you have met us at each place on this journey. God, you've met us in places and in ways that, Lord, maybe we're not even able to express or to recognize, but God, your grace comes to us before we even ask for it. So, Lord, may we respond to your grace today. God, may we take the first steps to love you and to love those around us. Lord, may we ask how we might love each other in the next moment we find ourselves in, to the next person that we encounter, whether they're just like us or completely different from us. Because, Lord, in that we will experience your love. As we look to you, Lord Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, may we love the world like that. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.